Welcome back to another episode of Sea Control Asia Pacific. Today it's a special edition brought to you from the sidelines of the Shangri-La Dialogue 2016. My guests hail from the Philippines, from the US, the UK, Australia, Indonesia and Malaysia. They'll be talking about the glamour and goss, the romance and rumble from this year's dialogue. But before we get into that, we'll be back after this short break.
SimSec brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. And, like the United States, SimSec is, and always will be, free. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership, which gets you daily emails of our articles and a WordPress account that sends your own writings directly to our editorial staff. However, admin, special projects, software, events, and prizes do cost money. There is a new option to make a voluntary monthly donation at the bottom of every SimSec article. No matter how you choose to support us, those who volunteer for leadership, our amazing content producers, our readers, our listeners, our conference planners and attendees, and our financial benefactors, we are incredibly grateful. Remember, Sea Control is more than just a podcast, and SimSec is more than just a website. We are a vibrant community built on a passion for discovery and discussion. Sign up, write, donate, comment, or even leave 5 stars on our iTunes page. Join us today.
Welcome back. As mentioned, the focus of today's episode is the Shangri-La Dialogue 2016. Since 2002, it's become the Asia Pacific's foremost intergovernmental defense and security summit convened by the International Institute for Strategic Studies. It's represented by 27 nations in the Asia Pacific by the defense ministers, military chiefs, defense officials, and academics. It's an opportunity to hear what the pressing current and long-term security challenges are, as well as for officials to hold meetings along the sidelines. You'll hear some of those ideas talked about in today's episode, and I'll be kicking off with Professor Romel Banloy from the Philippines. I'm now sitting here with Professor Romel Banloy, and we're going to have a quick discussion about Admiral Sun's talk at the Shangri-La 2016 dialogue. Professor Banloy, I just want to get your initial impressions of Admiral Sun's presentation in this plenary session.
Well, again, the Chinese official gave us another lecture on history, which we know already. But what we want to hear more is their points of view about the effectivity of resuming bilateral talks again, because our incoming president already expressed his interest to resume bilateral talks with China in order to address our differences on the South China Sea. And he failed to elaborate that further, and we want some more discussions on that.
That's very interesting. I remember Admiral Sun did say that he would try and work things out bilaterally and seemed to be quite favorable towards President Duterte's approach. Mm-hmm. I want to just take a little bit of a step back. Admiral Sun made some comments about UNCLOS. I was wondering if you could just elaborate on what those statements were and what your reaction is.
Yeah, the argument of Admiral Sun is that the Philippine government is using the UNCLOS provision on arbitration to justify our so-called illegal occupation of geographic features in the South China Sea. And for Admiral Sun, arbitration is not the only way to resolve disputes in the South China Sea. But for the Philippine government, we find it very important, because we want to advocate the rule of law in managing tensions in the South China Sea, because we are seeing more and more actions from China that we find very coercive, and that is not the rule of law, but we find it the rule of force. And that is why we want to assert the provision of UNCLOS in managing differences in the South China Sea.
I mean, specifically, Admiral Sun said that UNCLOS did not apply and that their government would not apply. What do you think would happen in such an event if the arbitration ruling came down in Philippines' favor? What do you think the way forward could be?
It's very clear to the Philippine government that China will ignore the decision of the arbitral tribunal and will refuse to enforce the decision. And that is why the incoming government is exploring the possibility of resuming talks with China, because we might get the legal victory from the court, but the greater challenge for the Philippine government is how to get the political victory. And we can only get political victory by asking China to abide by the decision of the court and enforce the decision of the court. And we can only do that by discussing that issue with China. So at the end of the day, although we'll get the legal victory, at the end of the day, we will still be at the mercy of China to enjoy our political victory.
And will that also depend on whether the President Duterte will throw his political support behind the arbitration ruling as well?
Personally, the incoming president is very critical of the arbitration process because he believes in the wisdom of direct negotiation. But since he is assuming the presidency with the arbitration as a reality, it's a fait accompli, so he needs to really implement it. But I think in order to resume bilateral talks with China and build greater confidence with China, I don't think Duterte will strongly raise the issue of arbitration. His priority is to repair damaged ties with China, and raising the arbitration issue will pose a major obstacle in the repairing of these damaged ties. So I think Duterte will set that aside for the meantime. But if bilateral talks with China will not yield any benefits for the Philippines, I think that the Duterte government will use the arbitration decision as a fallback position.
Just regards to those benefits that you talked about and the eagerness for President Duterte to reestablish bilateral ties, what is it about the broader Philippines-China relationship that President Duterte is seeking to restore?
First, President Duterte wants to restore political ties with China because right now the political ties have deteriorated very, very rapidly under the previous government of Aquino. And he wants to restore political ties because for him, restoring political ties is essential to enhance economic relationship with China. And Duterte is very pragmatic in attracting China to invest more in the Philippines and to encourage their tourists to enjoy the Philippines, and at the same time take advantage of military development aid coming from China, because during the time of President Aquino, no state investment from China, no development aid from China, and Duterte wants those economic opportunities to come, and the only way to do that is to improve political ties.
And last question for today, U.S. Secretary for Defense Ash Carter yesterday spoke about China's creating a wall of self-isolation. Given what you've just talked about restoring bilateral ties, to what extent do you agree with that statement about self-isolation?
Yes, China is isolating itself in the South China Sea by ignoring the arbitration, because everybody seems to approve Philippine actions to put the matter before international court. And that is why we don't want China to be isolated in the region. So President Duterte is reaching out with China by telling to China that, hey, I'm willing to talk to you again bilaterally. But Duterte is also telling China that if you're not sincere in working with us bilaterally, we have another option, and that is to reinvigorate our defense alliance with the United States, because that is a reality in Philippine politics, that we remain to be an ally in the Philippines. And Duterte, despite his criticism against American presence in the Philippines, sees the value of this alliance in order to increase our leverage in dealing with China. Yeah.
Excellent. Thank you very much for your time and for your insights, Professor.
Thank you very much, and I look forward to more discussions in the future. Thank you.
We've gone from a Filipino perspective, and now we're going south for an Australian perspective. With me is my former colleague and the Australian Strategic Policy Institute's Journalist Fellow, Mr. Graham Dobell. Thanks very much for joining me, Graham.
Hi.
All right, my first question for today, we've just stepped out of the plenary session. What were your first impressions of China's Admiral Sun's presentation?
Well, the nice thing about the Chinese Shangri-La the last couple of years is that the Chinese come ready to rumble. And that was a very fine rumble. And I thought it was quite amusing that the Vietnamese minister on the podium stepped back a little and said he wanted to give more time to his Chinese colleague, not least because what the Chinese are doing as we head towards the findings from the tribunal in The Hague is digging ever deeper into this great big hole coal every time they open their mouth. And today was another example of China talking about sovereignty and its ownership. And of course, what we're going to get from The Hague is a set of findings, binding findings, on the UN law of the sea, going to things like development of walls of sand and walls of islands. And so the more assertive, the angrier, the louder the Chinese talk, the more, in a sense, they dig themselves into a great big public relations hole, which is about to open up and swallow them.
There seems to be more to just its sense of digging itself into a hole. Admiral Sun also talked about the wide-ranging global role that China has. He talked about its role in peacekeeping, in humanitarian operations, and also providing defense assistance to other countries. We also had that stands in stark contrast with what U.S. Secretary for Defense Ash Carter talked about in terms of self-isolation. Which of those two narratives do you think is more persuasive, or do both apply?
Both apply because, of course, China is so incredibly important to the region. Its economic role in the region is just so important. And it's interesting to think for a moment, play a mind game. Imagine that we didn't have the East China Sea, the South China Sea issue. Imagine if China had essentially continued to hide and bide on the South China Sea. Imagine what that narrative would be. It would be about the Belt and Road. It would be about the Asian Infrastructure Bank. It would be about China's growing offers of infrastructure, the role of China as the great economic engine, and increasingly a China that uses the language, that ASEAN likes to hear about inclusion, about peace, about dialogue. The Chinese have got all the words. They know the language. They actually run the language out very well. So Ash Carter was all about principles. The Admiral was much more about peace and pragmatism and working together. So the Chinese have the language and they know how it works and they're incredibly important to the region. But every time a Vietnam or a Philippines looks at what the Chinese are actually doing, they put no weight on the words.
Speaking of language, Admiral Sun was very clear that countries external to the region must play a constructive role, but really it was countries inside the region that should be managing affairs. What role do you think this leaves for Australia?
I think Australia is always going to be dealt with as a US ally. We're always going to get caught up in that very old Chinese narrative of old Cold War thinking and old alliance thinking. But in a sense, that's almost the old frame that the Chinese have been using for a couple of decades. I don't think that that's where the real talking takes place. I think that the interesting thing in things like Shangri-La and in some of the older institutions like the ASEAN Regional Forum and now in the ASEAN Defence Ministers meeting is that you're now seeing these institutions and obviously the East Asia Summit actually trying to move beyond just the old confidence-building structures. And that's the interesting thing about where East Asia has evolved over the last couple of decades. We're still essentially on that first level of confidence building. And at the moment, there ain't much confidence and there ain't much building.
Seems like there's plenty of work for us to do then.
There's a lot of things for the commentariat and the digerata to do.
Certainly. Well, thanks very much for your time, Graham.
Cheers.
Moving from an Australian perspective now, we go to an American one, Bonnie Glaser from the Centre for Strategic and International Studies. Bonnie, I just wanted to ask you, first of all, what were your impressions of Admiral Sun's presentation today?
Well, Admiral Sun Jianguo said very little that we haven't heard before. He refused to answer any questions, speak extemporaneously on any issue. This is a repeat of his performance last year. I think that the Chinese are feeling a bit on the defensive on the eve of the arbitration ruling that is going to come down and is likely to be against China. I think that the Chinese also reacted negatively a bit to Secretary Carter's claim that their behavior is self-isolating China. So this seemed to hit a raw nerve, and he pushed back against that. But other than that, I really don't think we heard anything new. China is staunchly defending its position, and Admiral Sun Jianguo seemed to believe that if you yell it loud enough that you can convince people that your position is right. but he really didn't engage. He simply read a prepared sheet of paper, probably because he the safest thing for any Chinese admiral at that level to do is to not say anything that could provoke criticism back home. So I think his audience is primarily back in China, not really here. I believe there is growing concern in the region about Chinese behavior. There is a desire to work with the United States to counterbalance China. It is, in my view, almost dishonest for Admiral Sun to have said that in his bilateral meetings with other countries here and defense representatives that he found that they trusted him more than last year, and they were friendlier toward him than last year. I find it hard to believe that the Chinese don't know how much concern there is about them in the region. Hopefully, they have at least heard it and will write reports and pass it back up, and maybe Xi Jinping will come to understand a little bit more about what the thinking is in the region. I think this is very important. But we're really at a turning point in the region now. Will China seize the opportunity of this ruling to further advance its claims, to act more provocatively, perhaps to conduct more land reclamation at Scarborough Shoal, to declare baselines in the Spratlys and an air defense identification zone in the South China Sea? Or will China pause and take advantage of diplomacy to try and win the hearts and minds of the region, to really work together with countries? They could revitalize the code of conduct process. They could really shelve territorial disputes. They could actually come into compliance, potentially, with part of this ruling, which, of course, we don't know what it will be. But they, for example, they could stop interfering with Filipino fishermen that are fishing just outside of the 12 nautical miles around Scarborough Shoal. So China will have an opportunity, and we'll have to see whether they seize it or not.
You've talked a lot about what China can do. We're obviously standing here in Singapore. What can ASEAN states do, or other countries, other disputed countries, do best to move forward?
Well, countries need to build up their own capacity, and we see, for example, the Philippines and Vietnam doing that, because if they have more ability to know what's going on, just maritime domain awareness in their waters, in their airspace, that hopefully will deter Chinese aggression. So paying more attention to building up those capabilities. I think that these countries also can put some pressure on China to negotiate a CEWS-like set of protocols between coast guards. This would be very important, since the Chinese are using these former Navy ships, painting them white, and they are very capable ships, and then they're harassing fishermen from other countries. So this is something that Singapore and the Philippines have put forward, so there's more diplomacy that they can do. They can work together, engage in their own military exercises with each other. Some of these countries can consider bringing their own legal case to an UNCLOS arbitral tribunal. This has been discussed in Vietnam. They have not proceeded. But I think that actually using international law is a good way forward for countries. And if the Philippines wins, which I believe it will, at least in part of what it has asked the tribunal to rule on, maybe that will embolden some of these countries to do the same.
Thanks very much, Bonnie. Always a pleasure.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I'm now sitting with the Director for International Security from the Lowy Institute for International Policy, Dr. Ewa Graham. Thank you very much for joining me.
You're welcome. Hi, Natalie.
I've been interviewing people throughout the day about their impressions of Admiral Sun's presentation. It was obviously quite striking. What were your first impressions of it?
I thought it was a presentation of two halves. It went rather soft at the beginning. There was, an expected reference to the One Belt, One Road and the other economic-led initiatives that China has been pursuing. So it was sort of heavy on the carrot. The surprise was that the stick came quite firmly towards the end. And Admiral Sun seemed to sort of warm into that role. And I thought that really from a perspective of Southeast Asia being a target audience, the the fact that there was a lot of particular negativity towards the Philippines and the involvement with the arbitration bid, probably wouldn't go down too well with a new administration in Manila.
In particular, Admiral Sun said that his country would not be abiding by the ruling with arbitration and that the area in dispute was not covered by UNCLOS. What's your reaction to that?
I think that's it's worth noting, but it's again to be expected. China all along has said that it doesn't recognise the jurisdiction of the court. That's the first time I think we've had it crystal clear, expecting that an arbitration ruling. And one wonders actually whether the Chinese know what's coming to give that kind of level of preemptive rejection for a court process that still hasn't run its course. On that, we should bear in mind the timing of the ruling may not be the beginning of June as expected. It wouldn't surprise me if it went a few more weeks yet.
There have been a couple of changes. I mean, given the unknowns there, there is one thing that we do know, and that's that the Philippines has a new president in Duterte, who's now said that he's willing to approach China on a bilateral basis. With Duterte's ascension to that role, what do you think are the changes ahead for either the bilateral relationship or the way in which this issue is managed within ASEAN as well?
Well, for Ashton Carter, going back to the first plenary of the dialogue, he majored on the state of rude health of U.S. alliances and mentioned the Philippines high up the list. The fact that a new so-called EDCA has been signed off and access to bases that U.S. hasn't had on a scale since the early 1990s. Now there's a real wild card in terms of Duterte, who's been reported as having a somewhat scratchy relationship with the U.S. As you mentioned during his campaign, although he said lots of things, which weren't necessarily all consistent, but he did give a clear indication, a signal, you might say, to Beijing that he was willing to reopen the door to negotiations. So the wild card from the point of view of the PCA ruling, if it goes as expected Philippines way, it may not be that he pursues that through a continuing legal process. It may be something that he chooses to use tactically, as it were, in his back pocket while saying to Beijing, do me a deal, and then we'll work something out. That's possible. However, returning to Admiral Sun's speech, the fact that he went so heavy on the Philippines and included, interestingly, I thought a very diplomatic-style pitch to the successor administration that it should move away from the policies of the Aquino administration. China has to be very careful there that it doesn't back Duterte early on into a nationalist position. He could very easily turn out to be more difficult and less pliant a leader than they're expecting. And I think we've seen a similar theme to the way that China's relations with Southeast Asia have not gone the way that they would want. And although China very clearly wants to project the message that it's offering something that the U.S. can't and that Southeast Asia will have to make its peace with Beijing, if it continues to take the same mirror image nationalist line, then it can only expect to encounter more pull on the rope towards the United States.
Speaking of messaging, there was a session yesterday afternoon in which another Chinese military spokesperson was present, and that was General Yao. I've heard that her presentation was very different in style and substance. I was wondering if you'd comment, please, on the differences and similarities with Admiral Sun's presentation today.
It was quite clever in that General Yao, who I think is very much warm to the role that she's had in the recent Shangri-La dialogues, that she was arguing that China has law on its side, and she was presenting it in very confident partisan terms, that this is a question of interpretation. China takes a maximalist interpretation in terms of what the EEZ will allow a coastal state to apply in terms of restrictions to the transit of foreign warships. And I thought it was very helpful that there was the guru of the law of the sea, Robert Beckman, who is an American by birth but naturalized Singaporean. And that adds, I think, a message that China might find difficult to digest. In terms of his very clear exposition that the way UNCLOS was drafted, that high seas freedoms continue to apply within the EEZ, and that military activities, including close surveillance, is not expressly ruled out by the convention. So there was an interesting contrast there. And then, of course, we had a Vietnamese view as well, and a lively question and answer session, including some quite voluble interventions from the floor, because I think General Yao is not backward in coming forward, so she was encountering a bit of pushback too.
Now we'll just move a bit to Australia, which is now where you're working. There was a noticeable absence of Australia's Defence Minister, Maurice Payne. Some have speculated that was obviously due to the upcoming election. Can you comment on what impact that might have had, or whether you think she ought to have been here this week?
Yeah, I think from an Australian perspective, Australia has had a very strong showing for the previous 14 Shangri-La dialogues, always represented at minister level. So suddenly to not show up is not a desirable signal, especially in the year when a new defence white paper and many other developments in the defence and security field have happened, including notably a comprehensive strategic partnership with Singapore. So it would have been good, I think, to have had an Australian view represented, and there could have been, I think, some valuable messages that Maurice Payne could have shared. Now, there is an election, as you pointed out. I guess that's the obvious explanation, but we're still some weeks off from that. So, again, I think probably slightly disappointing that a few days couldn't have been found. After all, it presents a very good platform on which there's a huge amount of publicity. So if hearing the voice of the Defence Minister was the objective, I think it would have been very good to have had it done on a regional platform.
Dr. Graham, thank you very much for your time again.
You're welcome.
I'm now joined by two guests. I have with me a former colleague, Mercedes Page, who's currently an editor of The Strategist at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. And I'm also joined by Janet Dia-Ekawati, who is an independent defence consultant in Jakarta, Indonesia. Ladies, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you very much, Natalie.
Thank you, Natalie.
All right, of course, I have to ask about the event of the day, as I have with all my guests. Admiral Sun of China this morning gave a very, emphatic presentation on his country's position on the South China Sea, amongst other things. Just to kick things off, I wanted to ask what your first impressions of that presentation were. I'll start with you, Mercedes.
I think General Sun didn't necessarily say anything that wasn't expected from the Chinese delegation, but I think what's really stood out for me was his mode of delivery. So in previous years, I know that Chinese delegations have been criticised for not answering questions or really kind of putting on a charm offensive. I think there was no doubt at all in anyone's minds about China's intentions with General Sun's delivery, which was quite abrasive and very loud and bellowing, which definitely, I think, delivered his point really well.
Janet, what about you?
Well, I think I agree with Mercedes, because first of all, this is my first Shangri-La dialogue, and it's very different when you see someone talking like Admiral Sun on YouTube and being there and seeing him. So it was an interesting experience, but yes, there was nothing really new. And even during the question and answer sessions, it's like the answers you could guess from the previous articles or interviews or even other events previous to this Shangri-La dialogue. But it was really interesting. It was one of my favorite sessions in this year's Shangri-La dialogue, yes.
Excellent. And so just to want to contrast that a little bit, there was a presentation yesterday. It was a special session on the South China Sea. And there again, we had another Chinese military spokesperson, General Yao, this time. What was that like? I'll start with you, Janet, this time.
First of all, it was in English, right? So because Admiral Sun, of course, he spoke in Chinese, and it was translated. But General Yao, she spoke in very good English, and the way she presented herself, she's strong. She knows what she's talking about, and she knows how to answer really tough questions. So it was interesting. At first it was quite serious, but then we kind of laugh, not because of, well, I think it was an ironic laugh, but basically, if you talk about the South China Sea sessions, again, there's, again, if you talk about essence, the substance, yeah, it's again, we can predict what they're going to, about to say. Perhaps Mercedes wants to add something else?
Yeah, look, I agree with Janet. I think the contrast between General Yao and Admiral Sun was quite marked. General Yao is very approachable, very eloquent, very softly spoken, outlined China's positions, of course, but very strongly, so you left in no doubt about what those intentions or objectives are, but very conversational, very easy to engage with. And
I just want to add something. This morning, I actually met General Yao in the foyer, and I, you know, presented myself. I told her that I was the one who asked questions, and I gave her name card, and she was very gentle. It was a kind of surprise because, yes, she was very approachable, but when she answered questions, she said it was a soldier's answer, right? So it's like, but she was very soft. I was kind of surprised with the difference. Yeah, but again, she's one interesting individual. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, I've read that it seems some media have written that the Chinese delegation is more prepared this year. So they are more approachable, they are more media friendly compared to the previous Shangri-La dialogue. So hopefully, in terms of communications with the PLA or the Chinese military, hopefully that's a good sign.
Interesting. I just wanted to dig a little bit further into the Q&A session with General Yao yesterday. I believe there were some interesting questions about China's official position with the Paracel Islands. Does either of you recall? Yes, both of you are laughing now, yes, because there was an interesting response. Mercedes, can I hand over to you? And just, if you can give me a sum up of what the question was and what General Yao's response was.
I have to admit, my recollection of the exact question posed to General Yao is a bit hazy, but I believe it was along the lines of getting her to reconfirm what China's official position on the Paracel Islands was. And the question came from a Vietnamese participant, and her response was predictably, well, it's China's undisputable territory. That's what China's official official stance is, which drew laughs from the crowd. But she was also the same commentator also clarified one of her previous comments, which was talking about how, you know, China's not the only country in the South China Sea to request prior notification of passage, and pointed out that actually Vietnam requires the same thing. This commentator perhaps unwisely pointed out that, well, yes, you know, Vietnam does require prior notification, but we actually don't care whether we get it or not. And General Yao's response was, oh, so, you know, you don't care if you get prior notification. Yeah. Well, that's great. I'll remember that. Which was
it was like funny. A mic drop. So that was very interesting. You know, she I think she has this ability to really pinpoint on a, can I say, not maybe not weakness, but like a hole in what, like, for instance, the question from the Indian participant that has to do with the 1949 map. And I remember General Yao said that, because the Indian participant said that if it was based on historical maps, then the, you know, the world will be covered by the British, right? And
in terms of claims, right?
In terms of claims, right. And India will have, like, what, 50 dash line map. And General Yao said that, well, unfortunately, you did not inherit that 50 dash from the British Empire when you proclaim your independence. So so she was funny, sarcastic, and, and, you know, it was
cheeky.
Yeah, a bit cheeky, exactly. So it's like, you know, cool evil. Sorry, that's my wording. Yeah.
Mercedes, did you want to add anything to that?
No, although I disagree with the cool evil. But, no, look, it was a really interesting session. I completely understand why the Chinese or the CCP would send someone like General Yao as a representative to this kind of forum. It was really interesting.
Were there any other bits of this year's Shangri-La dialogue that you'll take away? Were there any sessions or any throwaway comments?
Well, I think, of course, for me, it will definitely be the, it's not part of the session, but it's because why I'm here. I'm part of the first double I, double S, Southeast Asia Young Leaders Program. So this is the first time for this year. So from 10 countries of ASEAN, we have, I think, around 42, young leaders, that's what they call us. So we had a very interesting session, a lunch session, including the Foreign Minister of Singapore, and then also the Admiral Harry Harris, U.S. PACOM commander, and then also a representative from Europe, and the Norway ambassador for Indonesia, and I think another country. So it was really interesting. It's Chatham House, yes, but it was amazing for me personally to sit down and listen to them talking. So it's not every day for someone. I mean, it's not every day that we can actually approach these kind of people and talk to them. Then they were quite frank in many ways. So, but for me, I will definitely take home this experience, and hopefully I could be a part of Shangri-La Dialogue next year.
And Mercedes?
I had two major takeaways from the last couple of days. The first was the focus, which was a little bit sidelined by the emphasis on the South China Sea, which is not unsurprising, but the focus or the recognition that climate change is increasingly a growing threat to the region, but also the world's security environment. And that was highlighted by the Thai Prime Minister Parikar in his opening address on Friday night, by Ash Carter yesterday morning, by the Canadian Defence Minister, by the Russian Deputy Minister for Defence as well earlier today. And I think that's a really welcome development, because climate change does pose a number of threats, and it's often disregarded in favour of more immediate threats. So that was, I think, a really promising development. The second major takeaway was that there was a lot of emphasis on principled engagement in the region and inclusiveness, and looking at how countries should engage with other countries and build a security architecture together. There's also a lot of emphasis on how the South China Sea arbitration ruling later this month poses a really good opportunity for the region to come together and to play by the rules in Asia, essentially. But there was very little discussion on what will happen in terms of practical action. Yeah. Mm. Following the ruling, when China's made it very clear today and consistently over the past couple of years that it won't respect the ruling. And I guess one takeaway from this weekend has been that no one was really talking about, well, what actually happens when the ruling is handed down and China doesn't cooperate.
Well, I just want to add on the practical thing, and I completely agree with Mercedes. One thing for sure is that the theme is definitely rules-based, inclusive, and of course Chinese will add shared security network or architecture. But again, maybe because I'm not sure, because maybe we are at the defense minister level. So yeah, good ideas, good intentions. But again, we asked about what will you do? What is the exact thing that, it's not just about China and US, it's everyone. So I think that's the question that I will bring back home and try to talk with some people in the defense and, of course, foreign affairs establishment. Yes.
Mercedes and Janet, thank you so much for your time and for your insights.
Thank you very much, Natalie.
Thank you very much, Natalie.
I'm now joined by Zihan Mahadzia, who is a defence journalist for Jane's, based in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. Thanks very much for joining me, Zihan.
You're right. Welcome, Natalie.
I'd just like to start with a couple of the other sessions. So far with my other guests, I've talked a lot about Admiral Sun, but I just want to talk to you, of course, on that panel, there was another speaker, and that was a Vietnamese general.
Yes.
General Nguyen, what were the main... Can you comment on what you think the main points of his presentation were?
I think the main points of his presentation was that Vietnam wanted a peaceful resolution of the South China Sea, but at the same time, he was keen to stress that the recent deal signed with the U.S. did not mean that Vietnam was in the camp of the U.S., but as I think the general stressed that he was, Vietnam was a proud and independent nation which has not been aligned to any country, but at the same time, it follows the norms and principles of international law. So I think the idea was just to make sure that they were not really taking sides, but looking towards their own interests, but in accordance with the global community. So.
And just moving to another panel session there with the Singaporean Defense Minister Ng, who was speaking, and he raised the interesting point about terrorism, noting the large number of people that could potentially be radicalized in his country. What was your reaction to his comments?
I think it's a legitimate concern for Singapore, because given the amount of Western interests and the U.S. Navy operating frequently in and out of Singapore, there's always the potential to be a target for a terrorist attack. And especially given Singapore's small size and population density, the Singaporeans have been taking very active measures preparing for any terrorist attacks. Noticeably, when the Paris attacks occurred, Singapore was one of the only Southeast Asian country to immediately put its soldiers out on the streets patrolling to prevent any terrorist incident. May have been a little bit of an overreaction, but I think they had a right to be very cautious on the situation.
And last question, of course, what was your overall impression of the 2016 Shangri-La Dialogue? Any changes with 2015?
I think the U.S. toned down its rhetoric a little bit, but the Chinese still seem prevalent in giving us their historical lecture on the South China Sea. So possibly, but then given that Admiral Sun was the speaker last year, I actually suggested during a Young Leaders Forum that maybe we should find another speaker from China next year. So that would be my perspective. But I think at the same time, it's been noted by many quarters that there were not that many new ideas or proposed. But I suspect also it could be also most countries are probably waiting for what happens when the new U.S. administration, whoever that is, comes in.
Excellent. Thanks very much for your insight, Zehan, and for your time.
Okay. Thank you, Natalie.
And that brings us to the end of our special edition on the sidelines of the Shangri-La Dialogue 2016. You can catch more of our speakers. Their Twitter accounts are listed on the SIBSEC website. Don't forget to give us a 5-star rating and join us for another episode of Sea Control next week. Bye-bye.